Hello, and welcome to the 27th episode of Wildfire Matters, the podcast that covers all aspects of wildland fire management for the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM. We talk with the people who help manage and protect our public lands, many who dedicate their lives to the profession. Today, Piper and I are talking with Robbie Swafford, Branch Chief of the Remote Sensing Fire Weather Support Unit, and some of his staff members, Justin Dopp and Cindy Scherfick. Welcome.
Thank you.
Better known as the ROS program, or the Remote Automatic Weather Stations. But we're happy to have you here today to talk a little bit more about what ROS do and what your program does. And before we get started into that, tell us a little bit about how you got started and how you ended up in ROS. Robbie, we'll start with you.
Okay. Well, my first delve into electrical work or electronics was an apprentice electrician for a while in Wyoming and also back in Missouri. And then for some reason, I decided to join the Air Force, which, you know, I think was one of the smartest moves I ever did. And while I was in there, I first started out as an administrative specialist. And then after 3 years, I cross-trained, believe it or not, into weather equipment maintenance. So I have been doing weather equipment maintenance since about 1987.
It's a long time.
It's a long time. I did weather equipment maintenance, and we merged with nav aids, navigational aids. So basically everything in the middle of the runway I worked on. And then from there, after leaving the Air Force, after 10 years, I worked for a company called IFR, making test equipment. And then another company called Schlumberger, which works with oil wells. They send tools, electronics down in the oil wells, and they log what's called logging the wells. That was really exciting. And but I got this notion to look online one day, and I saw a job opening for a weather equipment maintenance technician in Lander, Wyoming. And at the time, I was living in Rock Springs. I thought that would be a lot of fun and applied. And I didn't get the job because it was merit, and I wasn't able to get a merit job at the time. But I called the HR person, asked them, well, how do I get a government job? And this lady sat down with me through my lunch hour and told me how to get a government job and what I needed to do to apply. And so I went back and I looked online, and there was a job for a weather equipment maintenance technician in ROS in Boise, Idaho. And I thought, well, let's see if she knows what she's talking about. And in 2000, she did. So I got hired and been here ever since 2000.
Great. And I know we joke sometimes, but you're building your empire, which we'll get more into later. And Justin.
Hello, my name is Justin Dopp. I'm the depot section manager. And so, yeah, it's a little bit different how I got into this line of work. And so I moved to Boise, Idaho from St. Anthony, Idaho in 99 to go to school and finished up my 2-year degree in electronics technology. And then I was working at Micron as an electronics technician there. And during that period of time, well, not just that time, any time, that market's pretty volatile. And so out there, they were doing really well. Everybody's making a lot of money. And then the market kind of took a downturn. And I saw the writing on the wall because people higher up than me that were losing their jobs. So I was started checking around. I actually had a friend that worked at a temp service. She worked for Kelly Services. And she just said, hey, I have this job that came across my desk. And she thought I'd be good at it. So she said, hey, come in and just take a look. You just have to take a test. And it's a temp job, but it could turn into more. And so basically went in, and it's funny, the test that I took had nothing to do with weather at all. It was like a word processing test. It was just like, what does this have to do with anything? And so he's like, oh, you passed. So if you want the job, you can have it. And it was actually, I was like, wow, great, okay. And so that was at the ROS Depot as basically a temp, but a contractor working there. And I still remember my first day where Robbie was not the supervisor at that point. It was Buddy Adams, and he was an old Navy
Master Chief. Don't ever get it wrong.
And I remember showing up the first day and walking in, and he's like, who are you? I was like, well, I was supposed to start work here today. And he had no idea that I was even showing up. And so that was like, huh, this is going to be a good work experience for me.
How many years ago was that?
2003.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, yeah, went in, started working, like all the techs there were great. A lot of the technicians still worked there, and they'd been there for quite a few years before, but had really good training from them. I liked the group. I liked the work. What I like most about it is that with working at Micron, obviously you're in like a clean room environment or something like that. You're indoors all the time, where with this, you get to use electronics and you get to work outside. And that was kind of, I worked a lot outside with electronics before that. I worked for the phone company and did a lot of things over in Eastern Idaho. So I was like, oh, this would be a great job. And so that's why I really initially enjoyed it. Even though I was a depot technician, I got to travel a lot with the field group throughout my career, but basically spent 2 years as a contractor. And then after that, I wanted to go back to school and get my bachelor's. So I re-enrolled back in school at Boise State in 2005 to get my electronics engineering degree. And at that point, I said, because I was trying to do the same thing as Robbie, I was like, how do I actually get a full-time position here? Because I'm not military. And most of the people at that point were ex-military that were working at Roz. And they're like, well, you know, say a prayer, because you're probably not going to get a job here if you're not military. And so I talked with HR and said, well, you can go into the SCEP program, which is the Student Career Employment Program. And as long as it's something that aligns with this career field, you may get a job. There's no gain or guarantee. It's just you can do this and you get your degree and they may be able to non-competitively move you into a position, maybe not. So I just leap of faith. I was finishing, or I was going to school anyway. So I said, well, sure, I'll do it. Unfortunately, I took about a $30,000 pay cut to go from a contractor to a SCEP student. And so finished up my degree in 2005. And then I was lucky enough to get non-competitively moved into a technician position, a depot technician position there. And then basically was a depot technician from 2005 till 2019. And ran our IROS program there, which is our portable weather stations for the most part. And then I did our training program also. And then, let's see, 2019 moved into the depot supervisor position, which Robbie was in before coming to the depot or the section manager. And then after that, in 2023, moved into the depot section manager position. So I've had a few positions, never changed offices, so always been in the same office.
Nice.
So. Yeah.
Never have to move.
Never have to move. Changed offices. Well, I went from a bench to an office. But yeah. So but it's been, obviously the $30,000 pay cut worked out pretty well for me. So
sounds like it. You're still there.
Yeah, it is. And I like what I do. So yeah, I'm glad I did that.
Great. Thanks, Justin. Cindy.
Hi, I'm Cindy Scherfick, and I'm a Roz depot technician. So I probably have been more of a revolving door than Justin. So let's see. It started back for me. I was actually locating utilities, underground utilities, for a company that worked for Digline. So I also like the outdoors and whatnot. So I was around, I was near ITT Tech at the time when it existed. And I had gone inside to ask them a few questions of what they wanted located and done. And we started talking about what programs they have and whatnot, because at the time I had taken a few years from high school, just didn't go to school. I didn't want to do any of that at the time. So anyways, she said they have an electronics program that she thought I might be interested in, did a placement test and whatnot, and kind of just was a very easy process. So got into that. I was doing night school. I had bought a house at the time. I had a job that was pretty lucrative. And one of our lab teachers actually told me that NFSE was coming to the school to interview students for the SCEP program that they had. So again, the Student Career Experience Program, something like that. At the time, I think it's something different now. But I said, well, I don't know. Like, I just bought a house. I'm not, you know, I'm not looking for change. And she goes, I really think you'd like it. You go out in the forest in the summer. Like, it'd be a great opportunity. I was like, oh, I might as well apply and just say no if it doesn't work out. And so I put the application in, and a couple people from the radio shop came and interviewed all the students that had applied. And I said, I'm sorry, I really don't even know what I applied for. And so the lady that was interviewing me and stuff, she said they get that a lot, because I was a little bit dating myself, but it's a little bit before the websites and all this where you could
do some research. Yeah.
Yes. And growing up here, I never even heard of the Fire Center. So anyhow, I ended up getting some advice from people in my life at the time. They said, you should take it. Like, that sounds amazing. But I would just have to deliver pizzas on the side or something to make up for the cut and pay. But anyhow, worked at the radio shop for a while as a SCEP student. Once I graduated ITT and the SCEP program, I got a full-time position up in Alaska, Fairbanks, Alaska. Worked there for a couple years, but I was seasonal. So I would actually fly to Japan to visit my husband and then come back and work the season. But yeah, that was my first experience on the weather stations. So we were radio techs, and then we also covered the Roz stations. So we would fly to most of our sites that we would work on. So it was a great experience. And honestly, there was times I was in the helicopter just going, how did I even get here?
And you get paid for this.
And I'm getting paid. People actually pay to go do this. And I'm so it was neat how doors just kind of kept opening, and the experiences were amazing. I ended up leaving there because of my husband's career path with the military at the time. And I went into tower climbing. So I serviced cell phone towers and stuff at the time, which was another, like, just on the road a lot. What's that?
It's kind of wild.
Yeah. I was, for that company, I was the first female out in the field. And I was the only certified because of the SCET program. I got certified as a tower climber. And he's like, you're our only actually certified tower climber and only female. But anyhow, so then from there, my husband got stationed in Hawaii. So I stopped the tower climbing. We finally settled down, started having children. And when we moved back to Idaho, my old boss from the radio shop said, I heard you moved back to Boise. Is there any way you'd be interested in coming back? And I, you know, we kind of talked about some of the details, and I came back as a contractor, worked there for a couple years. And then at the time, they were getting rid of the contract position because they were able to get a full-time federal position. And Robbie walks in and says, hey, I heard what's happening with your contract. Are you interested in coming over to the weather station? I was like,
I stole her.
Yeah. Another door opens.
Another door. So it's just been a very good experience for me. So I went over to Roz and then worked there for, I think I was there for about 4 or 5 years. We were having our third child, and I had to go in and tell Robbie, I'm sorry, but I know we're going to have another one, and it's just going to be too hard to try and do a full time. So left that position, and then later on after things settled down again, I got another call and asked if I was interested in coming back again.
We just won't let her go.
I know. And it's just been a blessing in our family for sure all these years. So yeah,
that's great.
It's been my experience.
In the radio shop, we talk about a lot. It's just easier to say radio shop as opposed to the National Interagency Incident Communication Division.
It's a little lengthy.
Yeah. But right next door to Roz.
Yeah. Well, like, yeah, we're the remote sensing fire weather support. Yeah. Everybody knows just, this is Roz. Yeah.
It's just easier.
Acronyms.
Yeah. All right, Robbie. Well, let's get into what Roz does and what you do.
Okay. What we do is we maintain all of the fire weather stations across the United States. We maintain them for the BLM, the BIA, and the U.S. Forest Service. We also maintain some fish and wildlife regions and some park service stations, along with state and private. So we really run a whole gamut of, you know, fire weather across the United States. There's about a little over 3,000 stations that are actually in our program, you know, through our weather software. And we maintain,
2,300 of them. Maintain between the different contracts.
Yeah, 2,300. We have three different types of contracts, basically, or actually four. We have a depot contract where the owners of the station will order sensors from us. We'll send them to them. They'll put them on. They'll send us our old sensors back. We'll recalibrate them and put them back up on the shelf. Then we have a modified contract where we'll go out once a year and we'll maintain that station. And then if anything breaks on it, it kind of refers back to the depot where they'll order the parts and put it on. And then we have a full ride contract where we maintain the station. We calibrate it, we maintain it. They don't have to touch it. And then we also have a portable contract where the owners of the stations can send the portables in and we'll actually do the calibration of those stations and then send them back to them. So that's basically what we do. And we do this for all the federal agencies and a lot of state and private.
It's a lot of equipment out there in the field.
It's a lot of equipment.
Yeah, well, just our depot on the sensors that we maintain, we run over 6,000 sensors through the depot every single year. So, yeah, we do a lot of work with as few people as we have.
And how many people are employed at Roz?
Well,
currently?
So total between, because we have three offices. We have a Boise office, a Carson City office, and a Phoenix office. So between all three offices, we have 31 total. The majority of those are field techs because Carson City and Phoenix are all just field techs. So let's see, in Phoenix, we've got six now.
Six in Phoenix, four in Carson City as field techs. And, you know, our big unsung heroes is Kevin and Mark, our material controllers, because every one of those sensors, regardless of if it's going out to a customer in Florida or it's going to one of our field techs right there in Boise, goes through their hands. So those guys are extremely busy.
Sounds like it. So what kind of training, and can you explain more about like the training needed and the types of equipment specifically that you work on?
Yeah, so I mean, looking at like hiring people and the type of training that they would need to have, I mean, realistically, they just need to have some type of just basic electronics. So basically, whether it's a degree from a college, a two-year degree or anything like that, or most of our employees have military training that has to deal with either radar systems, radio. I think KIPP's even got some missile system training. So, but when it comes down to it, everybody's like, well, those are pretty specialized. Electronics is electronics. Like you could take a radio tech. He would know enough about electronics to come work on ROS. ROS tech could go work on radio equipment as long as people would know the basic electronics for it.
Like Cindy.
So, well, yeah, and that's just it, is that most people in our shop actually don't have standard schooling. It's mostly just military background, and that's what they did in the military.
Is that why? I know you mentioned that like was hard to get in initially because you weren't military. Is that part of the reason, because they have a lot of the military?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, just based off of veterans' preference retiring, right, which is how it should be, right?
Right.
But yeah, there's a lot of electronics experience. And yeah, and then when you get out of the military, as far as jobs go nationally that deal with electronics, this is about the best gig you can get, because we keep our track on just basically the job market and basic pay for electronic technicians, like nationally. And I mean, just to make sure that all of our people are getting what they deserve, or a national average. And people see our positions and they are highly sought after just because of what we do. And it's a good career field. So yeah, people get out of the military and that's usually the first thing that they're applying for if they know about it. But we are pretty specialized in that fact, is that most people don't know. Like, I think there's people at NIFC that don't even know what ROS is. They're like, you work at the base? You work on what?
Right.
And because we're just stuck back in the corner, it's like, you work on weather stations? So
it's not like a weather service thing.
You're the guys that drive
something?
The big trucks up and down the road, right?
Yeah, and it's just so most people don't know. And so it's really word of mouth. Like, most of the people that we get that apply for positions within our shop know somebody in our shop. And that's kind of word of mouth, where we just, I mean, that's kind of how a lot of people that apply, we know through somebody else. So, and they just happen to have an electronics background, which helps. So,
and you think of, you know, Corey Prescott, him and I were in the military together. He was, you know, we both worked at Comm Squadron in McConnell Air Force Base in Wichita. And Corey was a radio tech. That's what he did. And he always told me how beautiful Idaho was. I should come out, you know, and I'm like, yeah. And then I got out here and I went, huh, Corey was right. And a position opened up and I'm like, Corey, you should apply for this. Because I was working in the depot at the time. I was originally hired in as a depot tech. And a field position opened up and I talked to him and he applied for it and he got hired. He's been with us ever since, and that was in 2001. So, you know, and like Alan was an avionics tech. So he worked on all the electronics inside of jets and airplanes.
And that's Alan Hester, who's in charge of the field unit.
Yeah, he's our field manager. So
couldn't make it today. But
couldn't make it today. We tried. But, you know, when you take a look at even the guys in the military, they're a very diverse group, you know. And, yeah, it's kind of neat.
Sorry, I got a little sidetracked, but yeah, that was an important part to bring up because...
Yeah, just to answer the second part of your question, it's kind of the sensors that we work on. So, I mean, they're basic. It's weather equipment. So if you look at a weather station, we have a complement of sensors that each station has to have on in order to meet National Fire Danger Rating Standards. So relative humidity, air temperature sensor, wind speed, wind direction, solar radiation, precip bucket. Like, those are the main things. And then some stations have fuel moisture, fuel temp sensors on them. But then they're all, and then like charging systems, solar panels, batteries, and then we use the GOES network, which is a geostationary operational environmental satellite system that transmits the data up. So antennas, things like that, but a lot of electromechanical, pretty simplistic stuff. I mean, it's not like we're dealing with microprocessors with it, but you do have to know what you're doing, because a lot of the older equipment that we used to work on, when we fixed it, there was no board level repair. You took the board and you physically fixed broken components on the board. So everybody had to have board level troubleshooting. We really still like to have that when we hire somebody, and that's getting harder to find because you can buy an entire board for what it used to cost to buy a component. And so we do a lot of board level repairs now, but we still have a lot of older equipment because the federal government really likes to use things until the vendor hasn't supported it for 20 years, yeah, which is what we're actually doing. And so some of the old surface mount technology, We get in, which I always enjoyed because you could fix it. You could bring it in. You could actually troubleshoot
it. It's like your old cars.
It is. Like, yeah, just like working on an old car. You could pull out like all the transistors and the ICs and just like you could physically solder it because they were bigger. And now all of the boards that we look at are all micro components where it's like looking at salt and pepper. And so it's funny. I always used to give the techs a hard time because they couldn't see it because I was the youngest person that worked there. And now I'm in that boat where it's like, I can't see it. Like, I can't work on this stuff. It's so hard. So we have to use magnifying glasses. But
I was that guy he was laughing at.
Yes.
So, but yeah, we, a lot of good electronics and all that still has to go into work. And it's not like you can just get in and go, well, I'll just swap the boards out. You still need to troubleshoot to figure out what's going on. And so our techs are really good at that.
And there's a weather app that has all the ROS stations on it. So do you know when a part or a component goes off? I guess it would stop functioning, wouldn't it?
We have a pretty good system. You know, it started out when I first got here, we had this system called ASCADS. And if you can think of looking at the first Matrix with the green running down, I mean, that's what it looked like. Everything was in the
movie.
The Matrix. Yeah. It was
not like the Matrix that you live in.
No. Everything tastes like chicken.
Green running down. I see blue, but okay.
But yeah, so, you know, it kind of looked like that. And it got really strange when I started, you know, looking at it long enough and I could actually read it. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, it's getting crazy. But then we ended up going to another one called With Me, and it was written in a C++ language. And so it looked more like, you know, what you normally saw online. And, you know, it was pretty robust. And now we've actually transitioned over to what we call WX, and it's written in an APEX system. And it's amazing what our software engineers can do. We can think up something, go, boy, it'd be really nice if we had that. And like the next day, they're like, well, here, it works like that. So, you know, all that data comes in through, we look at data through our DRGS, which is our actual dish that sits out there at NIFSE.
Oh, that with the one that says ROS on it?
The one that says ROS on it. So
behind the weather service?
The GOES satellite system has two satellites, one in the east and one in the west. And we have that one pointed at the west because most of the station's high fire danger is out this way. And we also pull off the internet, and we also have two what they call HRIT systems. So one is pointing at the east satellite, and one is pointing at the west satellite. So we're very redundant on how we get our data because it's that critical. And, you know, when it comes in, we run it through, you know, four different servers are gathering it. We have our software system pointed at one. We can point at either one of them, but we have it pointed at one. And that data comes in, and we process that data, and then we send it downstream to customers. So, you know, like the weather service has two different components. They have a MesoWest, and they have WIMS, and it goes to that. It also goes to the Western Regional Climate Center down in Reno, Nevada, and they store our data forever.
Well, just but as far as you asked about how do we know if something's going bad, though. So with WX Weather, we have what's called station event reports, where it's just a software program, right? It's not a person that can physically look at it. So it does send out very vague kind of reports, but it does let you know. It's not going to send you an email and say, hey, your relative humidity air temperature sensor is not working. It will send out, it is how it looks at the data. Like if you have a value that remains unchanged for too long. So if you have a value that's stuck at zero for more than 11 hours in a row, it's going to let you know, and it will let you know what sensor is doing that. And then we have max limits and low limits. And so everything needs to kind of fit in a box. And if it goes outside of that box, then WX says, hey, there's a possible problem. And then it takes a person to physically look at it and determine if it's a problem. Like, I'll give you an example. Like, one of the station event reports is if you receive more than 1 inch of rain in an hour, it's called a delta error. It'll say, hey, you received 1 inch of rain in an hour. You may have just received 1 inch of rain in an hour. So that's where a person needs to physically look at it and go, is that an actual weather event, or is something possibly wrong at the station? At that point, that's where our technicians or the local point of contact would have to physically go out and get eyes on the station and just see, you know, what is going on. And basically all of the sensors on the station are set up within those station event reports, where they all are monitored to kind of stay within that box of what values are reporting. So yeah, it does help us find issues a lot sooner.
Cindy.
I know, we need to let her talk.
Yeah. I did have a question for you though. Like, what is your like kind of day-to-day job?
So for me, I'm on the depot side. So we are under lock and key. just kidding.
Keeps you in a dark room.
Exactly.
Slave drive.
Yes.
No windows.
Yes, that is true. So it depends on what sensor we're on. So each of the techs are on a specific sensor. And so I currently am on the relative humidity and air temps and then also the fuel sticks. And so that those are actually changed out every year on every station. So those get a lot of movement, a lot of traffic. And so we work in a specific room, chamber room is what we call it. And there's two of us and we're just kind of processing the sensors as fast as we can. And then, yeah, any issue ones, we troubleshoot down to the board component level. And then we have it kind of on a rotation. We are short staffed. But as we move through the sensors, like some of us, like the solar rads, we have a season where we have to be up on the rooftop working on down to, it's called the LICOR, the eye of it, I guess, of the solar rad. So calibrating those and so capturing these nice clear days where there's hardly any clouds in the sky. There's just so many things and you're learning so much. And one thing I love is you can also be creative as if you see like we can maybe test more of those up on the rooftop and capture these good days. We have a team of people that are up there and we're trying to get that extension going. So we're just kind of fabricating and figuring that all out together. And then same with our tipping buckets, like we need the system updated. So we get to jump in as a team and do that if you want to. But so anyhow, I think I like how it's challenging, but it's also rewarding as you get stuff done and turned out. So, yeah.
I always like going through the Roz. You know, you guys have all this cool equipment and techie stuff.
And I have to add all the bugs that come back in the sensors. I'll leave it there.
So you have to do a little cleanup too.
There's a little bit.
Well, you
got
to figure that all sensors are out there for at least a year, and some are out there for 3 years. So as far as the sensors go, though, cleanup is a huge part of. So that's one thing is like people that come in and think they're going to be dealing like strictly with electronics and like a clean room environment. This is not a clean room environment. You're getting sensors that sometimes they come back and you don't know what sensor it is. Like it may be encased in like a hornet's nest.
Oh, no.
I mean, those are like, we've had some pretty extreme, kind of like data loggers come back with so much moss grown on them that you couldn't actually tell it was a data logger. So yeah, there's lots of physical cleanup because we basically, to keep costs down, again, every year when we go out and do maintenance, we're not putting brand new sensors on the station. We're taking sensors that we pulled off another station, refurbish it down to component level, make sure it's good. We paint it, we sandblast it, we clean it up. So basically you're getting a brand new sensor for no cost. I mean, for the most part. So yeah, our technicians, I think a lot of people, that's probably the hardest part with new techs is they're like, we have to clean it. Well, yes, you have to clean it. Like you have to, that's before you do the electronics on it, you have to clean it. And so it's, yeah, we see that. So.
You don't think about that part of it.
Yeah. The environment's pretty dirty.
Yes.
Yeah. So it can, like I said, something for 3 years, depending on what type of environment it is. Like coastal environments are pretty rough on
with this equipment. Salt,
yeah, salt, high RH, yep, salt content, and then birds tend to damage quite a few things with, yeah. So,
how about animals?
I've actually got about 5 geckos in my house right now that came through Roz equipment because I just love geckos. So when they fall out of the sensors, I get them. And I got 5 little morning geckos right now.
And you don't know really where they came from?
They came from Hawaii.
Oh.
Yeah. We know we got a shipment in from Hawaii. And one of them had a gecko in it, and the gecko was still alive. And so they called me, and I grabbed it. And morning geckos, they clone themselves. So one female can have several. And I'm up to 5 right now.
Oh, wow.
I did not know that. And I also have a dead bug collection going on in my
dead bug collection.
Like there's some pretty cool ones that come back all still intact. So I've started a bug collection for my children.
The guys will go out and get a sensor from who knows where and they'll pack it up and bring it back. And that sensor's been out in the cold. So whatever's in it is dormant. But when you bring it into the shop and it hits, 70 degrees, all of a sudden your wasps and your bees and your hornets,
spiders.
Yes. They all come back to life.
So there's lots of spiders.
There's always an abundance of fly swatters, especially around the RH room.
Ever any snakes in units that come back?
I have
not so. I'm trying to think. It may have been Jimmy. This was way back in the day, but somebody did find a snake in a tipping bucket. It did not come back to the shop, but a snake somehow had climbed up and was sunning. The tipping bucket's got a funnel in it, and they went to take the lid off it, and there was a snake. I don't remember what it was, but anyway. But yeah, most.
I've been out in the field, and you do see quite a bit of snakes out there, but I'm not too many around or inside our stuff.
We've had a few pictures of rattlesnakes at the stations.
Yeah.
But yeah, nothing ever comes back.
Well, that's good.
Luckily, yeah.
You hear a box kind of rattling.
Yeah, hornets and wasps are the worst because they come back alive. And we may have had some mice, probably some mice and some of the portables that were not taken care of for the most part. But did you want to add to that?
Probably just some more damage from animals would be. We have seen bears attack the tipping buckets, and then animals, rodents just chewing through cables and things like that. So we do some more armored cables for certain ones. You know, there are some things that we've done to kind of execute against those. But yeah, so those are probably some of our biggest vandalizers.
Animal vandalism.
Yes.
Yeah, bears love to use our full-size stations as jungle gyms. They're fun to climb and bounce on. So yeah, up in Alaska, I'm sure you saw a lot of that.
What's the craziest animal vandalism that you have seen?
Well, I would say one for me would be we had one of our purple Ras over in Yellowstone on a fire there. And when was the fire in Yellowstone? Anyway, it was quite a while ago, but the station quit working and our techs went over and got it. And they're like, you're going to love this one. When they didn't tell me what had happened to it. And they brought it back and they said, check out the cabinet. And they showed me the cabinet. And on the front of it was a great big grizzly bear print. Right, it's gray, the cabinet's gray, but you could see a muddy grizzly bear print on it, and he went over and knocked it down and chewed on it and tore it up a little bit, and they had to go put a portable electric fence around the other units that we had over there. But that was probably one of the craziest ones. You see where he chewed on the cabinet, you can see his teeth marks in the aluminum. And then he tore the door off one of the hinges. So
we had one down in Nevada that we had a mating pair of ravens that would not leave it alone. And when we went down to work on it, you've seen the size of these. It's a tri-leg, and each leg is probably about 6 feet long. And this raven would make its nest in the middle of that with branches. And,
have to knock out then.
You'd have to knock out the branches and everything to be able to do the work. And then the next year, it would be right back again. And, of course, when you've got a couple of ravens and you've got a couple of baby ravens, it's just covered.
Oh, yeah.
Raven dung. Go ahead, Cindy. Top that one.
Oh. I remember a tipping bucket coming back that a bear had gotten hold of. It almost made it look like it was a pop can or something. I don't know if it's his teeth or what, but he had clawed into it like you use a can opener, to pop open it. So I think there's some damage that's done. Like some of those things, not quite repairable.
Right.
Humans are the worst. They're the worst animals. We've actually went up and found stations that weren't operating and went out to the site, and there may be a nut or washer on the ground because they've taken the whole station.
Oh.
Yeah. And that's probably about the worst. The solar panels. They took everything. The solar panels. Yeah, people like to take the solar panels and the batteries because they can.
But as many stations as we have, it's actually you would think we would have worse vandalism issues. Animals, I think, by far overall, do more damage than people. Like, we'll have a few stations that get physically vandalized by people a year, but it doesn't, compared to the damage that cattle, bear, elk, birds do. So,
well, that's good that humans you don't see that much of that. You'd think there'd be more because of the importance of the Ross stations. Bringing this back to fire management. I love the animal stories, though. But, how important are RAW stations to wildfire management? How has it changed over the years, do you think?
Right about the time I started, the permanent stations were really getting popular, and people started recognizing the need for them. And the network has grown and grown and grown. I mean, I think when I got here, there was probably about 1,000 stations out there, and now there's, close to 3,000, within the United States and Guam and America Samoa and Puerto Rico. So their importance, I tell people, when you take a look at what we do, we're providing weather data that they're using to see trends for possibilities of fire. And what's really neat about it is, you know, you've got scientists out there and meteorologists that really know what's going on and how to use our systems. And they can predict where we need to be able to put assets and stage them there because it's got such a high fire potential. So they're not only looking at us, they're looking at, you know, their ladder fuels and everything else around it, but our data is very critical for them to be able to make all of that judgment. I always tell people, you know, when you see the little Smokey Bear sign out there and it says, you know, your fire danger is low to extreme, they're using our data to be able to do that. And, you know, when we look at the IROS program, when I first came here, it was a fire ROS program. I think we had 5 units, and then we went up to 14, and now we've got 60. So the change in how people perceive that micro weather that's generated from a fire needs to have something on it. You can't have something 5 or 10 miles away. You need something right around it to be able to see what's going on. It's amazing how much that has changed and how much we're able to give to the community. I've always been proud of the fact that, you know, we, you know, knock on wood, but we've never lost a firefighter to burnover when we've had a raw station out there. You know, we've the ones that we put out there not only transmit every 15 minutes to the satellite, but they've also got a VHF radio on them. And so they can get a spot weather forecast just by pushing the buttons on the radio. It also has alarms in it, and we work with the FBAN and the IMET in order to be able to, for them to tell us what they think the thresholds should be. And we set those alarms. So if an RH drops, it'll come up and say, you know, warning, 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 station, whatever RH is, and it lets them know what the RH is so that they can make really good decisions on, well, should I go down there or should I not? Should I back out? And that's one of the reasons we do this is we're really proud of the fact that, you know, we're doing something for life and property, you know, hoping to be able to save these firefighters when they're out there doing the job they're doing. Because it's a very hard job, what they do, you know.
Absolutely. Well, and they depend so much on weather, on what it's going to do and forecasting and having instant meteorologists, the IMETs too, was, I remember when I first started in fire, I don't remember seeing them going to, you know, on incidents, but now pretty much all incident management teams have them out there to help with that weather forecasting and with the incident ROS and then the permanent ROS. So it's whether they deploy a IROS if there's maybe not a weather station or weather stations in the area of the fire. It depends.
And, you know, what they're looking for is, you know, because fire creates its own weather, it creates its own wind, as you know, because it's sucking that air in. And it'll create its own thunderheads, you know, with the smoke coming up. So stations that are permanently around there are, if they're in the area, that's great. But if not, you know, you may have 2, 3, maybe 4 stations around a fire, around the perimeter of the fire. And as the fire grows, our technicians will move those stations, you know, to wherever they need them. So with a permanent station, you would never move it. But with these, you'll put them wherever they feel the greatest threat is. Kind of what they do on a control burn. They'll take a project ROS and they'll put it out on a control burn and they'll sit there and get data. And as they do that control burn, they'll move that project ROS around, you know, in order to, you know, keep the public and themselves safe.
So how are the IROS deployed and ordered?
So basically, once a team gets deployed to a fire, so type 1, type 2, type 3 team, they have the availability to order an IROS through the IROC system. And so basically they place that order up through the local dispatch area, and then it would go through the geographic area coordination center. And then from there, it basically would get to NIC, or NIC division here at the fire center. And then basically once they get that, then they place it down to us. And then basically at that point, we start trying to figure out, now that we have 3 shops, because we didn't used to have 3 shops, which is going to be better where we're actually going to have IROS located in Phoenix and Carson City, so we can do better or faster deployments depending on where the fires are. So not everything's going to come from Boise now. So basically once we get that, determine what's going to be the fastest as far as what office to pull it out of, and then start dispatching texts. And then we just place the order in IROC and say these are the physical units that are going, because we have to keep track of them. They're a national or an NFES number associated with them. So they will get issued to the fire, and our techs usually will load up. Typically 2 is about the minimum that a fire orders, and we usually just tell people order 2. If you only need 1, you only need 1. And then they're going and meet up with the IMET and the FMET at the fire, and they tell us where to deploy them, and our field techs are getting them into some pretty harsh areas. So helicopter, I've seen guys just pack them in on their back. I mean, they're pretty big too. Yeah, they weigh a lot. Yeah, they're a couple hundred pounds in the boxes. So, but yeah, they'll go in and set them up, and then basically if they get there and they need more, same process, they just order more. Our techs will wait there and we'll ship them out. And then usually what our techs do, because we usually don't stay on fires too much after we do a deployment because we don't have time, we're usually, our techs are out supporting multiple fires and also doing our permanent station annual maintenance. And so they may go to fire, deploy two, and then they'll may get called to another fire, and they'll drive another fire, and then we'll just ship additional units from our Boise office or wherever to get to them. And so basically when our techs go out, it's very rare that they would just hit one fire and do deployments. Usually they're hitting multiple fires. So yeah, they stay busy.
I will add to that. So during my revolving door time, I was able to still do AD work. So I would go out on fires if needed or if I was able. And so able to get that experience. And yeah, it's actually nice. And even as a depot tech, we're able to get red carded and go out on fires if able. And so having that experience and those, it's kind of adventurous because you're not just sitting in camp. You actually get to go out. There's been times where we've actually had the fire retardant coming down on us on our side by side because you are right in the midst of some of it because they need those readings in certain areas. But of course, trying to plan that where it's either already been burned over or, you know, it's shifting so the portables aren't being burned over. So it's kind of a nice little adventure at times.
How long do you leave an IROS in one spot? Does it just depend on conditions?
Yeah, it's really up to the IMET and the FBAN. If they need that data in that area, we'll leave it there for the entire fire. Or if, you know, they want us to move it around, we will. So we're basically working for them at that point.
And did you say that you sometimes have multiple on one fire?
Okay. Yes, yes. When we had the old Visla systems, it was a big deal that when I was down on the Rodeo Chedisky fire, you know, when that was a big complex, we put six of them out there. And that's the first time we ever deployed six around a fire. Now, it's not a big deal, but back then, you know, you may have one or two. But as big as that complex was, we had six of them going on.
How do you determine placement?
So a lot of times they'll ask us or they'll tell us kind of where they want it. Sometimes the FBAN or the IMET will do a flight and they'll go, oh, that's a good spot for it. We want it there. And they'll take the coordinates and they'll give them to us. And then if we can drive there, we'd much rather do it. If we can get there with a UTV or a truck, that's better. Simply because when the fire starts ending, all these assets that were on one fire all of a sudden go to another one, including all the ships that we need to be able to pull our stuff out. So if we can do that, that's what we do. And if we get to an area and we look at it and go, we really didn't think that was that great of an area, we'll call back and let them know, and we'll place it in a different area. And we've worked with these guys enough, and they know what we do, that, you know, they really do trust our judgment. But it's really up to them if they really want it in that area. And sometimes, you know, we don't understand why. So I was on a fire over in Oregon, and we put this station in a place where I'm like, this is not good. And they go, you don't understand. We are looking at, you know, the fog that's coming in. So we want to know what that fog effect is coming up the side of the mountain and how far it comes up. And it's like, oh, okay. But you learn something new every day.
Yeah. And they're not just used for fire.
No. Right? We've been asked to deploy these at hurricanes. Our very first deployment, Kip Watson, who's still in our shop, built this little portable unit out of Pelican cases, and he deployed it on the Exxon Valdez oil spill. So that was the first actual portable deployment. And we put them up out at Ground Zero when that happened. The shuttle disaster, we were called to do that. So anything and everything that needs a weather station, they'll give us a call and we'll come out. EPA has found out about us, and Coast Guard has found out about us. So, yeah.
So other agencies are ordering these too?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Not just fire agencies.
Not just fire. No. Yeah, they were pretty shocked at Ground Zero when they asked us how quick could we get out there, and said, we'll be out tomorrow. And they went, what? You're a government agency. You don't move that fast. We do.
Well, on fire, we do.
We do.
So give us one thing that you're most proud of or the success of the program.
That's probably about what's going on right now in the program. It's been several years that I've been knocking on the door of the Forest Service and the BIA to be able to take over their maintenance. We used to do the maintenance for the BIA, and then it went to a contractor. And with the Forest Service, we've always done a lot of their work as a depot contract, but not so much as a field contract. And in the last couple of years, you know, we were doing about 350 stations in our field side. And, you know, the BIA came up and working with Cheryl Bright, she and I sat down and worked out a plan, and she presented it to the BIA and they accepted it. And we took over their program, and it's worked real well. They're very happy. She's very happy. And then when that happened, Nicole Finch from the Forest Service was kind of watching too. And, you know, I was always like, why are you sending all your portables up to Canada when we're here? And so she goes, okay. And she gave us the portable contracts. And then Region 3 of the Forest Service, which is Arizona and New Mexico, called me up and said, hey, we kind of want you guys to take over all of our maintenance down here for our stations on the field side. And so we worked out how much it would cost and everything, and we did it. And I didn't know it at the time that it was a trial run, you know, because that's what it seems like now. They put us in the one region to see what we would do, and when we got that region, you know, off of noncompliance, and everything was working great. And the next year they knocked on the door and said, hey, we want you to take over the entire Forest Service. Well, I gasped because that's everything. That's 50 states, and we have people in the 9 Western states. So I sat down with Grant Beebe and Chris Glode, and I put a business plan together of what it would look like if we took over Fish and Wildlife and Park Service with BLM, what it would look like if we did that with BIA, Forest Service, and Department of Defense, and taking over everything. And Chris always teased me that, you know, that's Robbie's plan of being king of the world and taking over the Raw's world.
That's why we joke, your empire.
My empire. So I, you know, when I first did this and was showing the business plan, I actually thought that it would be more DOI. It would be Fish and Wildlife, Park Service, and BIA coming over. And it really just knocked my socks off when Forest Service says, no, we want you to take this over. What's it going to take, you know, for our side to be able to make this work? And we sat down and we negotiated, and the Forest Service was really good and said, yeah, okay, we don't see anything that's out of line. Let's go. And so October of this year, we took on the Forest Service, which meant that, you know, where I had 2 people down in Phoenix, now I have 6. Where I had 0 people in Carson City, I have 4. And we added 2 more field techs here, and we added, getting ready to add a bunch of depot techs to be able to keep up with the work that we're doing.
Well, that's really a compliment to what's happening with the program and all the work you all are doing to have the Forest Service say, hey, you're doing a great job. And just, here's our hundred. How many do they have?
It's a big slap on the back for all the people that work in Raw's. I mean, you know, when we first started this project and started doing it, we're still in the depot. We're down about 5 techs and a supervisor.
4, yeah. So we'll be hiring 5 hopefully here.
Yeah, too. And these guys are doing that work without those 5 techs. And it's amazing that they know there's light at the end of the tunnel. My biggest concern is I don't want to burn them out, you know. And our field techs in Boise are actually coming in and working when they're in, you know, because they'll be out like a week on the job in the field. And then when they come back in, they're actually going over to the depot because they realize how important it is to be able to keep all of that going. As you know, one supervisor told me, you don't want to mess with your seed corn. The depot is the seed corn. If we lose the depot and we're not making sensors, it doesn't matter how many field guys I have. I need the depot to produce. They're the backbone of everything that goes on. So saying that, you know, my depot techs, I've heard no complaints from them. My field techs, you know, when we were gearing this up, you know, I've heard no complaints from them. They've come up and said, you know, yeah, we know there's light at the end of the tunnel. We know we got to, you know, just grit our teeth and bear it and we'll get through it. And slowly but surely we are.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that. I'm proud of how we've grown because we didn't used to be this big. It's like I said, I've been there for 20 years and we had a hard time getting contracts. Like BLM was always our permanent contract agency, but everybody else, we'd get a few and then we'd lose them and then we would get them back. But I look now, why did we get all the contracts? It's not because we provide crappy service. It's because we provide really good service. And people started seeing, wow, look at how all the BLM stations are always compliant. They're never non-compliant. They always work. They always provide good data. And so now we're doing that with BIA and Forest Service, and hopefully at some point Park Service and Fish and Wildlife. But like, that's a testament to all the people that we have in our shop or in Carson City and our Phoenix offices too, is that this is something that I love most about this job, is that like everybody that works there cares about what they do, like every single person. And I've never worked at a place where everybody cared about what they did, about supporting the mission, providing good service, providing good customer support. Like, this is a testament. When we provide rods classes, we teach people how to maintain the stations if they're on a depot contract with us. So they have to physically go out and do what like our field techs do. And so they come to Boise, and I have technicians in a shop teach the class. And we do a questionnaire at the end of every class, and we always, you know, ask for input. And I don't know how many times I've received the same input, but it's always this, that people always say, I never realized that people could be so passionate about RAWs. And multiple people say that. Every class I get somebody that says that. And it's like, that's pretty cool that everybody here cares Absolutely. That much, that like they teach a class, a three-day class, and people here for a three-day class go, wow, these guys really care. And so that also helps, I think, serve like the purpose of how important the weather data is. Because when I first started in 2003, we had a really hard time getting people to understand the importance of weather data. Like, I remember sitting in an office or in a meeting one time, and a certain individual who I won't name said, well, I can get weather data off of AM radio. It's like, well, where do you think that weather data comes from that you hear on AM radio? I mean, and so trying to get people to understand, like, these things are really important. And throughout the years, I think because of what the Ross Depot has done with everybody caring and providing good service, and then us just putting out good weather data, it's just helped the program grow. And now I think everybody's buying in outside of our office, where it's like, wow, this is really important. Because even just over the past, say, 5 years, I think there's been a huge growth of just people who really are focusing on the weather now, and now they really understand the importance of it. And so, but like I said, I think that's a testament to everybody that works at Ross, because they care about what they do. So,
well, you can tell when you walk in there too.
Just a plug on that. We were talking about some of the stations that were going where they were not compliant, and we were noticing, because that wasn't people's full-time jobs, they were adding that to their plate. And so many of these stations would go ignored because they just didn't have the time, or probably some of it is like, I do that once a year, I don't know what I'm doing. And so that, I think, has helped. But we also have a help desk that we man Monday through Friday. And so we help people all around the nation that can just call in with any question. And so that, I think, too, just providing that customer service and making sure people, it's approachable instead of this big unknown and how to even go about it. So,
and with our help desk, it doesn't matter if you're a customer on contract with me or not. If you call in and you've got a question and we can help you, we're going to help you. It doesn't matter. We care more about the data that you're providing somebody. We want to make sure that you're given the best data possible. So it's not about a money situation with us. It's about making sure that that data is correct.
We've even had emails from college students going into weather and stuff. Some I've had to pass on to Justin because I couldn't quite answer all of it. But yeah, there's some good people that want some good knowledge of the background on this. So
what's that number?
208-387-5475.
And that's only call that if you have issues with your rods stations.
Yes.
Or have questions
about it, yeah.
I know some people have missed it. I've gotten a couple calls because my number's close to that. My office number's close to that. And like, no, I'm not the Ross, but I know where they are.
I know they are.
But people call in, I mean, not with specific Ross questions, but just with weather data questions. Like Cindy was saying, we have college students call and say, hey, I'm writing my thesis on some type of, you know, climate change or weather-related value, and I need some input or things like that, where it's not specific to a Ross. But yeah, so we get a lot of calls from people who, like, non-agency people, just people out in the world, like students or just somebody. Like, we had a call one time from a hang gliding association. I always remember that one because I took the call and I'm like, how did you get our number? And they used a weather station for safety purposes for wind speed and wind direction before their club would go out and hang glide. So, I mean, it just shows you, everybody's like, oh, they're used for fire weather purposes. Well, yeah, that's the main thing, but they're used for everything now. Anything weather related, people are pulling data from Ross. So it's, like I said, pretty important.
Yeah, and I've always talked about going up on a site one time and pulling up to a ranch, and the rancher says, yeah, your station's a quarter mile that way, but I'm not going to let you cross my property. You need to go all the way around, and there's a road, you know, down there. And I said, do you know what that weather station's for? And he goes, no, it doesn't do me any good. I can't get the data. I go, well, sure you can. I go, let me show you. Can I, you got your computer? Can I go in and show you? And he goes, sure. So I walked in his house and got on his computer and logged into, I believe it was WRCC, and showed him where that weather station was because it's on a map. Pressed it for him, and I go, here's the data for that weather station. And I went through and was telling him everything that was on it, and I got down to the fuel moisture fuel temperature. And I said, yeah, that fuel moisture fuel temperature sits 6 inches off the ground. And so if you look at that, you know, in the wintertime and it's 32 degrees, that means there's snow on it. And as it starts to warm up, then the snow is getting less than 6 inches. And he looked at me and he said, you're kidding me. Do you know how many times I have to come up and down this mountain in order to see if the snow is low enough for me to bring my cattle up? And I said, no, sir. He goes, so if you take this road right through my property over there, there's the weather station. Just be on the other side and be careful. There's a lightning storm coming in. There's a lot of lava rock over there. He let us cross. So now he's using that data. And, you know, you tell ranchers about the RH that's on there, and they can get that because if they're cutting hay and getting ready to bale it, it has to be a certain humidity out there for them to be able to do that, or they'll get mold. And so...
And save them some trips.
Yeah, if you show them the data and let them use it for what they want, you'd be surprised at how many people want to use the data after they see it.
Well, and even for lightning storms coming in or a storm coming in, and if you have animals out in the field, you might have to move them. So that could be useful for that as well.
And with that, like where they get the data, we have the new platform, RWX Weather. And so I don't know if that was said, but we have now where it's a read-only, so the general public can just go on the read only and pull up stations and look. So that's, I thought that was a nice feature. Yeah. It's instant. You're not having to wait for the other ones to
get. That was a Justin feature.
And you can access that online through the NFSI.gov website as well.
Yes.
Find it. Weather.NFSI.gov.
Yeah. That's our plug.
That's right.
Yes.
Boom, boom. Because we put that website, we still have meetings every morning where we're adding functionality to it daily. So like any days we just say, boy, it'd be nice if it could do this. And so we talk with the programmers and they put the feature in. And so it does. We took basically all the best implements from all of the other weather data sites. So like Western Regional Climate Center, MesoWest, WIFME, and then we can kind of combine them. And so now we have map data in there where you can go see map data. We have the read-only version where you can just, you don't have to have a login to get into it. So you can get in and you can just look at a map and it shows you all the weather stations in the United States, and you can click on it and see everything. And so, but it is, it's a great site. So that would be, yeah, my plug is that anybody who needs to look at weather data, yeah, weather.nfsi.gov is the best place to go. And if anybody has any ideas on anything that they'd like to add to it, that would be a good time to provide that information to us where they can just go through our RAS help desk. And if it's something that we think is plausible, that's going to help people out, we would add it into the system. So,
well, how fast an hour goes.
Yes.
In closing, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, it's just been a fun ride. It's been a fun career. And I'm just happy to go. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, people look at me now as I'm getting a little older and they go, when are you going to retire? I go, when it quits being fun. And so far, it hasn't quit being fun. I work at a really cool place that has, you know, really outstanding mission. And I work for good people. Our fire center management staff is great. And I got great employees that make sure that I look good. And my job is to make sure that they have what they need to make me look good. And they do a great job at it. So, yeah, Justin, you're going to have to wait a little while longer.
I might retire before you.
I doubt it.
I would just say, just another plug, anybody who's interested in RAS, they can go to our RAS webpage, which is RAS.NFSI.gov. So a lot of good information on there, just talks about what we do, has some contact information for all the different agencies, things like that. And then I guess another thing I'd throw out there is that if this is a career field that you are interested in and you have an electronics background, I would just say to monitor USA Jobs, because we're going to have some depot technician positions that hopefully will be opening up here within the next month. But I've said that every month for the past year.
I was told today we are the number one priority.
Yep. So this time it might be for real. So hopefully have at least 4 depot technician positions, maybe 5. So yeah, we're looking for good techs.
That's a good plug. Good way to end it. So thank you, Robbie, Cindy, Justin.
Thank you.
For joining for the
27th episode of Wildfire Matters, and talking more about ROS, or the Remote Sensing Fire Weather Support Unit, and how important it is to our firefighters, but other people use it as well for other things, hang gliders even.
Yeah, there you go.
Awesome.
If you have questions, comments, or even suggestions on different topics for our podcast, please email them to blm_fa_nfc_comments@blm.gov and use Wildfire Matters Podcast in the subject line. To learn more about NFC or the BLM, please visit our website, nfc.gov, and follow us at BLM Fire on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
And thank you all for listening. Please join us next time when we spark a conversation with somebody. We don't know who yet. I'm trying to line that one up, but it'll be a surprise. So stay tuned. And until then,
stay safe and be wildfire aware.